There was a night in July 1964 that has some, that is a very historical night. And it was the night the Rolling Stones played at Danceland. What were you guys doing that night?
Playing a gig.
We were at the Marion Hall.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, should I tell that story?
Yeah, tell that story.
Well, we had some friends that went out to Danceland. Yeah. And they left early because they said there was only 50 people there. So they came over to the Marion Hall. We had like 500 people at the Marion Hall. And I said, you're kidding. 50 people? No, obviously they didn't know what they had. And it was before they were really big. It was, they were just being kind of introduced to America. And so they didn't draw anybody in.
The Beatles were really the big name at the time. And they were the next entry from the British.
Right. And they were the bad boys. Anyway, I heard it didn't go too well for them out there. So we were surprised that we had more people than they did, which turned around immediately. But
did your band do any Rolling Stones songs?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which ones
did you? All over now. And I remember we did that slow tune.
19th Nervous Breakdown.
Well, that was a little later. You're talking about the very first stuff?
During the 64, 65.
Yeah, we used to do It's All Over Now and...
Satisfaction.
Little Red Rooster. Well, off that first album, I remember there was a couple of the basic tunes. And Satisfaction came out when I was a senior in 65.
And that's really the one that did it for them, that got them established over here. And, of course, then because it was a popular tune, we did it in the band. And Lonnie was with us at that time. And mm-hmm. so he was able to pull it off vocally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you guys go to the Dayton's Top 10 Club shows?
Mm-mm. Nope.
Nope.
I did.
Do you recall?
Lonnie and I went down there one time and met George Harrison's sister.
Patty Boyd? Patty? No, that's his wife.
His sister. I can't remember her name, but she looks just like George Harrison.
She was in for a promo for...
Yeah, it was some kind of a... It was before they played here. In 66.
65.
65. It was before the Beatles played here. And she was, when I think of it now, I think she was riding on her brother's popularity. She was promoting something. I can't remember what it was, but.
No, I was with you on that gig. That was a band called the Remo Four.
That's right. That's
what. And they were a British band. That was the first British band I ever saw, was the Remo Four, and they were from London. Was their manager. That I remember that.
That was at the auditorium at Dayton's downtown.
Yeah, that was the only time I ever went there.
10th floor auditorium.
Wasn't it 7th floor? Anyway,
The Remo 4, that's a pretty obscure band. What did you think of them?
Well, I thought they were kind of interesting because they were that's the first time I ever saw Vox Amps live. You know, I seen the Beatles using them, and they played a little sort of that skiffle kind of rock, you know, which was kind of different from what we were used to seeing around here. Sort of a rockabilly type.
What did you think of the Yardbirds?
Oh.
Well, we were in love with them. We're still in love with them.
Yeah.
Did you do any Yardbird songs in the Ravens?
Oh, my God. We played with them. They've used our stuff. We were totally immersed in them for about, from whenever they first came out to when the Ravens broke up, we were totally immersed in the Yardbirds. Yeah.
How did you wind up getting a gig with the Yardbirds?
Well, the way I understand it, they were doing their first tour in the U.S., and whoever their booking agent was had them.
They were at Dayton's.
They were at Dayton's, and they played some places up in northwestern Minnesota, or one that I know of.
Maple Lake.
And,
and then they went to, like, Fargo or Jamestown or Grand Forks or someplace after that. They were on a tour.
So which gig did you play with them?
We were at Maple Lake Pavilion in Maple Lake, Minnesota. There's the only thing out there is about a 5 or 6 room hotel, this ballroom, and a whole bunch of marshland.
Yeah,
that's all I remember about it. There's nothing around.
Well, what I remember about it is Jeff Beck was playing guitar and Jimmy Page was playing bass in the band. And And it was just shortly after this tour that Jimmy Page went on to do his Led Zeppelin stuff. And so,
well, this was 66 now. This is in the summer of 66. Yeah. But as soon as they first came out, in 64, we were kind of getting into them. But that particular gig was in the summer of 66.
So the Beatles come to town in August 65. Were you guys around at that concert? Oh,
yeah.
Or?
Yeah, we went to that.
I went to
that. I was there.
Mm-hmm. What'd you pay for a ticket?
I think I paid $6.50.
Yeah.
Something like that. It was under $10.
Yeah, it was $6 or something. I remember King Curtis opened for him.
Wasn't there a number of different opening bands?
Yeah, they had Cannibal Curtis and the Headhunters.
King Curtis, and then I think one other.
I saw Nystrom playing in the hallway with the Accents. He was playing in one of the
Big Three.
The Big Three were playing in the halls.
In the walkways adjacent to the stadium.
At the Ole Miss Stadium, yeah.
Right.
And I was sitting right behind first base dugout, and they came right out in front of us. So I remember that part. And they sound, when you could hear them, they sounded really good.
Yeah, there was so much screaming, it was hard to hear. Intense.
Dave, where were you sitting? Do you remember?
Probably about mid first baseline.
Did you know these guys at this point?
Not at that point. We didn't know.
No.
Okay.
We didn't know him or Dave.
I was still in high school. I never met these guys.
Yeah.
Okay, so the British invasion is on. 64, 65. The Beatles come to town in August. What happens next with the Ravens?
Recording.
How'd that come about?
We got to go back just a little bit. In the end of 64, beginning of 65, we ran into George Garrett at Nickel Lake Records. And we actually went down there to talk to him because we knew he produced the Trashmen. And we talked him into bringing us in the studio, which he said, sure, come on down. So me and Dick and Lonnie and Harry Nils went down there and we recorded, I believe it was two songs. Everybody Tells Me and I Want You to Love Me. And he was real happy with it. And we went home and we were all pumped up. And
what kind of equipment did he have?
All they had was Ampex 4-track down there at the time. They had a live reverb chamber room, which was the signature sound of the Trashmen, that reverb. They had a room that they made this live chamber out of. And that we were just wide-eyed kids, and this was, kind of the big time to us playing in that studio with everybody else that was recording there at the time.
Were those two original songs?
Yeah. I think Lonnie wrote both of those. I think so. And so they put that out on Twin Town label.
That was a George Garrett label.
Garrett's label, his other label. And then he brought us back two or three times. We did Mrs. Brown, You Got a Lovely Daughter, and then it just so happened.
That was the Herman's Hermit song?
Yeah, but it was right before they released it, so we were going to release that.
How did you know of the song before?
George came up with that. He said, this is a good song you should do. He thought it was going to be a hit, so we did it. And I asked personally, I thought we did it better than Herman did myself, but because we had more to it. It was more harmonies and stuff. But anyway, then we did a couple of our own. We did a song called Whenever and a song called Love Pill that George Garrett came up with. And this was all through 65. And that did get charted on KDWB, Whenever did.
So the first 45 would be what? Which two songs?
I Want You to Love Me and Everybody Tells Me.
Okay. And then the other second 45 was?
Then the second one was Whenever.
Whenever.
And the backside was Love Pill?
I think so. I believe so. And then
let's hold on a sec there. Did the two Ravon 45s get any airplay?
Yeah, Whenever went to like 37 on KDWB's charts.
Okay.
And that's when we started working with Dave Anthony. And together with that, that's when we really started working a lot because we were getting radio airplay and we had an agent now that was booking us a lot.
How did you connect with David Anthony?
I happened to run into him. He was doing a Trashmen show on commission at Schlieff's Little City.
Where was that?
That was in Mendota Heights, I believe it is.
Invergrove.
I was 52 and something.
Yeah. He was taking tickets at the door, and he was bragging to somebody in front of me that he was producing the Trashmen and all this. And I thought I didn't know if he was full of hot air or not. But I said, I asked him if he used, you know, booked any other bands, and he said, sure. What do you got? So I gave him our card, and he called me the next day with like 10 dates. Wow. The very next day. So he was for real, and we worked with him for a long time.
Was he able to get you more jobs into different places?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he did.
Now, you also recorded for Recar.
You want to talk to him about that?
Recar?
The Line.
Recar was another George Garrett label that he recorded at his studio below Nickel Lake Records.
Okay, so what went on with this song, The Line?
I don't remember the song, but I remember the studio. It was kind of a dark, dank place, and it was just really, you know, compared to K-Bank Records, it was like
K-Bank Studios.
K-Bank Studios, yeah. It was kind of a thrown together type of place. I don't remember what we cut down there.
But. What we cut was another George Garrett song that he said, it was his idea. At the time, there was a thing called line dance that was real popular, and all the kids were doing this line dance. Okay, it was a real popular thing. So George suggested to Lonnie that he write a song about this line dance. So Lonnie wrote a song called The Line.
Okay.
And that was one of the songs we recorded down there, along with.
I remember now.
There's there was a couple other ones that we did. Baby Don't Love Me, that's one of them, and I think there was another one that we didn't finish. But those were the two in the studio, and he put those out, and so that was the last Ravon's single.
So the
that
last
was released.
So the last Ravon's 45 is on Recar, and it is The Line. With Baby Don't Love Me on the flip side.
Right.
And what happens with that 45? Any airplay?
We got a little airplay, yeah. Got a little bit. It helped a little bit at the time.
It helped with the bookings.
Yeah, it helped with the bookings. Didn't sell any records that I remember.
Tell me about some of these out-of-town places, out of the Twin Cities. You guys played up north by Nisswa? Brainerd?
Blazer.
Everywhere.
Blazer.
The Blazer? Dave, you remember the Blazer?
Mm-hmm.
What was that place like?
Great.
Very small.
You'd spend the night. Maybe you'd spend the night there.
Run by a lady that was wonderful. She's really a nice lady. I don't remember her name.
So that was actually in Nisswa. That's north of Brainerd, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
a little bit. And that was early South 40.
Yeah. We had been. Did you play there in the Jokers? Because we played there a number of times.
Probably in the Jokers too.
Yeah.
Okay, with the Ravons, what other outstate places did you play?
Iowa.
We used to play. Ravons played all over the place. We played at Approaches Ballroom
in
Wisconsin, and then we played at Bloomer. We played schools all over the place. A lot of schools. New Munich ballrooms, mostly ballrooms and schools at that time. We didn't play any clubs at all, hardly that I remember.
You mentioned Iowa. Did you play the Roof Garden?
Yes.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Not as the Ravons.
No. I don't think we ever went down there as the Ravons.
No, we played a lot of those ballrooms in Iowa. Fort Dodge, Iowa, the Bancroft Ballroom, Olean, Iowa had a ballroom. The Surf we played at in Clear Lake.
You got a mind like a steel trap. I don't remember any the names of those places.
They all kind of run together. I just remember the names of the cities mostly. And in South Dakota, we played in a place called the White Star Ballroom in New Effington, which was basically a redone barn with cows right outside. And
speaking of barns, what about the Purple Barn?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, yeah.
And the Safari Club. And
Safari Club is
Schlieffe's,
out east.
Right by Schlieffe's.
On the east side of town?
Yeah.
The Safari Club?
Yeah, it was right on 55 going out to...
is that the one in the basement?
Well, in South 40, we played in the basement and upstairs. We used to rehearse there, remember? We played when we first got together.
That was Bobby McKay's club.
Right.
Oh, Bobby.
Yeah.
So it started out as Bobby's? And then turned into the Safari Club?
No, the other way around.
Other way around?
It was Safari Club, then it was Bob's.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's the way I remember it.
Yeah.
But the Purple Barn and the Purple Cigar in St. Louis Park, that was South 40 gigs. That was a little later.
Someplace else.
and someplace else. I mean,
played there a long time.
And
Magoo's.
Oh yeah,
Magoo's City.
Now tell me the story of how Mr. Lucky's changed into Magoo's. Is that correct?
Well, Magoo's was next door to what they called New City Opera Hall. New City Opera Hall used to be called Mr. Lucky's. So they just, the same guy owned both places, and he just had a door going in between them. One was Magoo's, the other one was New City Opera Hall. And that was in the later 60s, 67, 68.
The Opera Hall was more like a small ballroom.
Yeah, it was a small, when it was Lucky's, it was.
Spirit.
Yeah.
Played there once.
Yeah, we saw Spirit and Santana down there, and there was like 10 people there.
Wow.
They didn't know who they had in there.
Now I'm going to back up a little bit to George Garrett. When you recorded in his basement studio, were those demo tapes, and then you recorded in K-Bank?
No, was it. He was, as far as we were concerned, we didn't go back into K-Bank as the Ravens.
What did you record at K-Bank?
As the Ravens, all those ones I told you already. The I Want You to Love Me Whenever, Love Pill. Everybody Tells Me.
That was, I think, it.
That might have been it.
Okay, those were recorded at K-Bank, not in the basement of the record store.
Right. Yeah.
Got it. What was K-Bank Studios like?
That was great.
I liked it.
It was great.
I loved the sound in there, and I loved the reverb system they had. He told me how he did it. I asked the engineer how he did it one time, and he said, well, we have to be careful because sometimes... What we have is it was an upper room above the studio, close to the road, to the street, and they had a microphone on one end of it and a speaker on the other, and they would let the sound come out the speaker. It would be re-recorded by the microphone, and the delay in that is what was causing the reverb.
Well, that's that live chamber I was telling you about, and they let us go up and see it. When we, it's still there. The room is still there.
Who was the engineer?
Oh, goodness.
Well, the guy that we were using...
Tom Dowd was there for a while.
We used a guy named Tony Kyrie.
Yeah.
Tony, who was a guitar player, and he worked for George at Nickel Lake, too. And there was another guy that...
That goofy guy.
There was a few goofy guys that worked on there. I can't remember their names, but...
What about the equipment? What kind of equipment did K-Bank have?
Ampex tape.
All they had was Ampex tape, four tracks. At the time, that was state-of-the-art. And immediately after that, they started getting the Scully stuff, the A-track stuff. But when we were there in those days.
But you remember when we used to, we'd have the reverb coming out, and it was set at a certain level, and then we'd start playing, and the guy would say, okay, hold it, because there's a truck going by out front, would come through.
That did happen. As a matter of fact, when we recorded with Garrett, I remember we were doing a vocal overdub. Me and Dick and Lonnie were singing, and I think he went in the can. This is at Nickel Lake down in Garrett's studio, and he flushed the toilet and went on the track. You could hear the toilet going.
that's how barbaric it was.
It was pretty gross. But
was George Garrett there during the recording sessions?
At his studio?
At K-Bank.
At K-Bank he was. Yeah, he saw him at the other studio too, but mostly it was us working with Tony, Kyrie.
Was it a pretty quick process to record back then, or did you do some overdubs?
We did two songs, I think, in 3 hours at K-Bank. We did everything. Well, we did the track.
Yeah.
It was bass and drums on one track and two guitars on the other track, and then it had a vocal.
And then we'd ping-pong them.
Well,
so you had more tracks.
You had one lead vocal track, one background vocal track. The guitars were on one track, and the bass and drums were on the other. That was the whole four track, and it went pretty fast. We knew the song, so it went pretty quick.
Was Garrett connected with Amos Heilitzer as far as distributing the records?
I'm not sure what the relationship was at that point.
Okay, so The Line and Baby Don't Love Me, they were not recorded at K-Bank.
No.
That was the basement studio.
Right.
Okay, and the 245s were both recorded at K-Bank.
Well, we had 345s. Two at K-Bank, one at Recar, which was...
Right, three total.
Yeah.
Okay. How long did the Ravons last?
till 67. Just before that, we had met the Joker's Wild, and we were all booked by the same guys, so we were hanging out together. And that's when we kind of made the switch. Everybody kind of switched around.
I remember Bruce
had
the idea to take some people from this group and some people from that group and put it together and call it a whole new group, and that's...
And then the remainder of the guys would get together, too.
And they were called another group.
They were the Jokers. Lonnie went with the Jokers, and me and Dick and Kink and Dave Wagner and Harry became South 40.
Who's Bruce?
Bruce Brantzig.
He was an agent that worked for David Anthony Productions. He actually was he was assigned to us because Dave was working with other groups too, and he was sort of a junior agent that worked there, and he was sort of directed at... Bruce was sort of focused on the South 40 band.
Well, he had other groups. He had the Loves. He had the Marauders. Right. And they all kind of brought work into that place.
The preceding interview was recorded at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota on January 30th, 2010, and was produced by Danny Johnson and Tom Campbell.